Bandwidth for December has been provided by CacheFly, the fastest, most reliable CDN in the business. CacheFly delivers all of our content here at 5x5, and they're the best. Check them out at cachefly.com, C-A-C-H-E-F-L-Y, and let them know that you heard about them here on 5x5. And I'm recording.
I'm recording, too.
Hey, I'm recording, too.
Here we go. 3, 2, 1... We recorded this episode on December 15th, 2015. This is On the Grid, episode 146. This week, Andy digs in on an idea from the last episode. Can anything ever be objectively good or bad? Here we go. Hey.
Hey.
Andy, you okay? Yelling Andy?
But yeah, man. Screaming Andy. I'm fine. I'm great.
So upset about accent walls and paint.
I just brushed my teeth before this podcast, and I feel clean, fresh.
So freshness means that you're not frustrated. Or yelly, or anything. Like, that just absolves any sort of yelliness.
Oh, don't...
Annie must be stoked, because brushing your teeth is like the opposite of painting, if you think about it.
It's like paint thinner, but for your teeth.
Right, it's just getting down to the white walls. Hi, Andy.
You know, you did this thing, and I don't think you did it on purpose, and I'm not mad about it.
Of course
you did. But what you did in the last episode... is you edited out all the stuff that made me mad. And so basically, the episode was like going along normally. Then there was a little music break.
Yep.
And then when it came back, my voice was twinged with frustration because of how mad I had
been. I did notice I did that.
And you cut out all the yelling.
But the alternative was really painful. The alternative was so painful. You didn't have to deal with it. I did. I mean, you had to deal with it one time. I had to deal with it two times.
I'm not saying you made the wrong decision. I'm just saying that that's what you did. And so...
I did do that.
The result is all the things that made me mad were cut out, and me being mad was left in. Some of it was.
Well, no, not all the things that made you mad were cut out. Just the repetition of things that made you mad was cut out. I kept it in 1 to 2 times instead of 17 to 18 times.
Mm-hmm.
For the sake of our poor, poor audience who had to listen to paint last week.
If we have any audience
left. It's like listening to paint
dry. No. You should have kept the proof because we had to go through it, and everybody else has to suffer with us.
Why were you suffering, Dan? Please tell us why you were suffering.
Because I had to listen to the two of you go back and forth.
Dan, you took an Ambien at the beginning of that episode, and actually, you might have, I don't know if you were even there at the end. Were you there at the end? I can't remember.
No, I was totally there, but like, I couldn't even get in because the two of you were just like back and forth and all like frustrated and yelly at each other and everything. It was like mom and dad were arguing at the dinner table, and I was just trying to be quiet.
Okay, well.
Oh, dear. I'm sorry you feel that way, Dan. I want you to know that we want you to argue at the dinner table, too.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's what the podcast is.
I am so glad we're a dysfunctional family. What?
Tell Andy I also want you to argue at the dinner table.
I'm not doing this.
It's your father's weekend, so you'll be making this podcast with Matt, and then next podcast is my turn, and we're going to have a more fun podcast. I'll take you to the zoo. I bet your mother didn't do that.
Uh-huh.
But your father...
Andy has a very fun weekend, but... his apartment is very sparse.
Yeah.
It's just white walls.
Yeah, just
there's
white
nothing.
Walls.
This is...
No. He's got a bed in the shape of a race car.
You sit there and you go, I really miss mom's accent walls. These walls are just so plain. It's like a prison.
Oh, you two are terrible.
No, you love us.
Yep.
I did actually want to do some legitimate follow-up. We're not going to get angry, though, I promise. I did listen back to the show, and I got to say, one of the parts that I was most surprised by, having listened back to it, was I made what I believe to be a pretty straightforward statement, and both of you responded with like a that's not okay kind of attitude. And the basic statement was just that there are good things and there are bad things. I specifically had said music in the episode, but is that not something that we all accept, that there are good things and there are bad things? Is that not okay?
I'm not sure if I accept that. At the time, I was very much not accepting, but I also might have just been in a general mode of not agreeing. Sometimes it's hard to tell.
Sometimes you just lock in. It's true.
You just lock in and then nothing after that point is going to be agreed to.
Mm-hmm.
But to be totally honest, I used to think that more frequently, that there are just some things that are just good and then there are some things that are just bad. And that's the way it is.
It's not that they're... I don't mean to say when I say that they're...
Well,
like
for example, Andy, if we could just start like some sort of political party where we just voted for the right things.
You just like before we record an episode, you read my Twitter timeline for the past week and a half and try and find something to sneak in there?
You brought that up to me specifically, and you also just, you basically just said there's good and there's bad. And you, like 5 minutes ago, you were just making fun of that concept. So I don't know.
Well, I, first of all, I don't think that guy that I screenshotted from Facebook is the same situation. Because,
okay.
Well, you know, Dan, why don't you jump in here? Because I feel like you're just snickering in the background. And people always want to hear more from Dan. So Dan, why don't you explain why there aren't good things and bad things?
Because good things and bad things are very often just a subjective interpretation of what is good and what is bad, and that changes from person to person, from culture to culture. So you can't say that something is universally good or universally bad because that's a narrow concept.
Okay, so if you can't say that there are good things and there are bad things and there are things worth your time and there are things not worth your time, what is the deal with all of the degree programs out there? What's the deal with our job? What are we doing if not learning how to make things good and not bad? If everything is just subjective, it doesn't matter.
I feel like, well, with our profession, if you're going to scale it back and talk about graphic design, it's just...
We can talk about anything. We can talk about music. I don't know as much about music, but people study that to get good at it, presumably, not to, you know, get bad at it. So if there is no good or bad, what are they doing studying music if it's all subjective?
Well, you can become more technically skilled and still not be good at it.
Yeah. Thank you, Matt. I was about to respond with that.
I don't know if that's what people are studying.
Yeah, no, they are. Yes, yeah, they are. That's
well,
totally what they are.
If you go to music school, what are you studying? Like,
there's
taste,
whole classes
are you studying
in
like
music theory.
Sure.
So what is a class in music theory? What's a class in graphic design theory? What's a class like?
But with music theory, you're exploring like different scales, different modes, all the different cores of how to be able to create music, not necessarily to make one genre or anything, but to explore a multitude of things just to get a better understanding of what you're capable of. So instead of just writing like pop music, you could be writing classical or anything, and also an array of instruments as well. So it's just like broadening your concept of what's capable within that profession.
So you feel that way about music and also about like graphic design programs and other, you know, creative programs that offer education in these things, that they're not influenced by a particular perspective or taste. They're just simply equipping people with the tools, and what happens after that is none of their concern.
Well, the issue is that like the curriculum itself should be the idea that you're just broadening the capabilities and concepts for the individuals going through the curriculum. However, they do end up being biased based off of the professors because they have their own backgrounds and their own experiences that they will say, based off my experience, this is something that has worked in the past. And they kind of...
Oh, I agree with Dan so much.
Yeah. So it just gets very complicated because the abstract is actually something that could be more objective if it wasn't for the subjective bias of the people that are participating in that construct.
So what does that mean when you extrapolate it out then? Is it just that what I'm identifying as good and bad, you're saying, is just the taste of a great deal of people over a great deal of time?
Yes.
And is that not valuable to talk about the taste of a great deal of people over a great deal of time and give a word for it?
Yeah, it could be, but you can't say necessarily all those things are good and bad. That's just your own perspective of what could be good in your own taste and what's bad in your own taste.
But see, it's not my perspective, though. There are things that I know are good things that I don't like, that are not for me, that are not to my taste, but I know they're good things. Like, for example, The Shining, I know to be a good movie. I watched The Shining. I did not enjoy it. I don't like being scared. It's not the kind of movie I'm ever going to watch again. But I think anybody that appreciates movies would say The Shining is a good movie. I've never seen anybody be like, nah, that's a hack. That's a bad film. I don't think that's a coincidence. I don't think that's just, you know, a bunch of subjectivity piled up over and over again. I think there is a skill to making something creative, whether it's music or design or a movie. And when you do that well and you do that consistently, there is something we should look at there and study and celebrate.
Well, and it's also weird, too, because if you say something like that, like with The Shining, where it has just a lot of fanfare around it, like a lot of people who feel like it is good, that's their own subjective take on it. Like there's, like if we're talking outside of things of like how the movie was created and constructed and all that, a lot of people will say it's a good movie because they enjoyed it. And you are saying that you don't like it, but it's still technically good. And you're basing that off of a lot of people saying it's good. But like, internally for you, you're also saying like, I don't like it.
No, I'm basing it off of watching it and feeling like, wow, this is a good movie. I'm being emotionally affected. This is compelling storytelling. These characters are complex and interesting, and I care about them. And also, at the end, I don't want to watch it again. I didn't enjoy that experience. That's not a story I want to be exposed to. But I can still appreciate those things, and not to the degree that somebody that studies film, I think, can. But I think it seems, here's why I respond strongly to this, because I feel like this idea that everything is subjective is just a thing people like to say because it makes it seem like they are very accepting and they are open to everyone's opinion and they're not at all elitist. But deep down, I think both of you know that there are things that are good and things that are bad, and you just don't want to admit it because it makes you seem like an elite jerk to say that there are good things and bad things. But I mean,
well,
no. I say stuff like that all the time. Like, there's certain music that I'll say, and I know this is my opinion when I say it, that like, no, this band is terrible. Here's all the reasons why I think it's terrible. But that also could potentially rub other people's feelings of like they actually like the band, and maybe they're just not so passionate about their feeling towards it, you know?
Well, I was going to say, it's not even deep down, I think, a certain thing. I think I'm probably more, it's more like me to just loudly pronounce something as bad and not think about it that hard. But if you ask me to deep down if I'm going to question it, I might be like, well, I mean, it is my opinion. I don't have concrete evidence. I'm less than what Dan said. I'm probably going to be like, eh, that sucks. And then not explain why or why not and let it go. But if someone was really going to grill me on it, I'd probably have to admit that I don't. If we're talking about my favorite band, I'm probably not going to have all the reasons in the world that it's great. Probably have some reasons, but I don't think I can refute it beyond a shadow of a doubt.
This week's episode of On the Grid is brought to you by FreshBooks. I know a lot of you out there are freelancers, or maybe you're helping to run a small studio. And trust me, I know from experience that creating and sending invoices can be a total drag. If you're like I used to be, maybe you're creating your invoices in a design program, doing the math on line items of an invoice yourself, and emailing them off to your clients one at a time, slowly wasting away your youth on spreadsheets. No more! FreshBooks has made it their mission to create an easy way to send polished, professional-looking invoices in seconds. Not only that, but they'll also help you manage your expenses, stay on top of your unpaid invoices, and track your time accurately. They've got a mobile app, so you can run your business from anywhere, and you can download reports for all your most important metrics. In fact, it says here that on average, FreshBooks customers double their revenue in the first 24 months. Start taking your business seriously and sign up for FreshBooks today. To try FreshBooks for free for 30 days, just go to freshbooks.com/grid. That's freshbooks.com/GRID, and enter On the Grid in the How Did You Hear About Us section. A great big thank you to FreshBooks for supporting 5x5 and On the Grid.
You can extrapolate this. Like, I think people can't even decide on this in just like moral judgments of things. There are people who don't even believe that you can call like certain cultures good or bad, or like the behaviors of certain cultures good and bad, because they're a thing that has been done for a long time. I don't necessarily think that is true, but that's a take on the world.
That's a sticky wicket we could get down. But I think that particular example, Matt, for me, it's people oftentimes not only extrapolate to that level, but then also like bring it back in and say all the people that participate in this culture are therefore bad, and those people can't help it. They're just raised in it. Like, I think to a certain degree, what people really take offense to and have a problem with, rightfully so, is the taking of some culture or a set of ideals and assuming that everybody that is at all a part of it is completely brainwashed by it, which that seems like a different kind of thing, maybe.
I don't know. I think it's all kind of part of the same thing. It's just one seems a little bit easier to make pronouncements about because it's about good and evil, as opposed to just good and bad with very little consequence other than it hurts your ears or hurts your eyes.
I am kind of surprised by this. So I feel like I had the feeling going into art school, probably I was closer to where you two are, where it was like, oh, everything's subjective. Everyone's just got their own thing. Who cares? Whatever. And I feel like what art school taught me was to separate my own ego from the things that I was talking about. And I feel like a lot of people take it personally. You're like, oh, that's a bad band, or that's a bad movie, or a bad whatever. And they, you know, throw their arms up and, you know, get super pissed off that they like this movie and you think it's bad. But, like, I like tons of bad shit. I've watched The Room probably 30 or 40 times. Like, there's tons of bad things that I can really appreciate and want in my life. But that doesn't make them, you know, paradigm examples of whatever creative, you know, pursuit they are an example of. And I just, like, it seems so obvious to me that we can look back at history and study the things that were great and try and learn what their greatness came from and try and not emulate it, but learn from it and bring that to our own work. And that's like, if you're not going to admit that things are good and bad, like, what do you look at to study? You just look at everything, like, without any scruples and just take everything in because somebody somewhere probably likes it. Therefore, we should get good at all the things.
I mean, I think there's something to be said for cultural relevance. Mm-hmm. This is a thing that seemed to capture everyone's attention around a period of time. What are the reasons for that thing doing that?
Yeah, and to me, that's like cultural studies, right? That to me is like, you know, you're studying pop culture at that point. That is separate, I think, from whether it is a good thing or not. Like, everyone was obsessed with that that song. What was the song that got a billion hits on YouTube first? What was that one?
Oh, Gangnam Style.
Yeah, sure. Everyone was obsessed with that, right? I'm interested in studying that as a cultural artifact, as like an anthropologist almost, of trying to figure out what was so interesting to that about people. But I don't think anywhere along the line do you have to say, oh, this must be good music because everyone loved it. I think you can separate those two things.
I think you can say that you have a gut instinct about whether something is good or bad, but I have nothing to back it up. So maybe I can feel that way, but I don't have any point to argue
about
it.
Do you have anything to back it up with? You couldn't explain a piece of design that you thought was great and successful and explain why it was great and successful?
I can explain why things technically work and technically don't work, but overall defending a piece, just like not the technical skill of something or the pieces that are functioning or not functioning. I can tell you what I like about something, but that doesn't mean that it's good or bad.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
That, and it's also like, there's a difference between good and bad and successful and not successful. Like, you could feel like something is actually good, like it's constructed well, but is it going to be successful is a entirely different conversation. So Gangnam Style was successful, but there's a totally different conversation whether or not it's like good or bad music, you know?
Yeah. Well, that depends on the values of the community that you're measuring that goodness by, right? Like, mm-hmm. The business world, corporate America, capitalism measures success equals good, right? It doesn't matter what mm-hmm. it is. It was successful, made money. It is a good example of that thing, and we should do more of it. And for one of the things that I appreciate most about anything creative is that very few, if any, creative things have that value set, right? Very few people are like, okay, well, whatever opera sells the most tickets must be the best opera. We're just going to do that. I feel like people that study opera have a different set of values that they're sort of measuring themselves against. And that's really valuable, I think. And if you're not,
you can set your own goals. You can set your own goals. That doesn't have to, that's not the same conversation necessarily.
I mean, but if you're setting goals on an industry-wide level, like, there's a culture around that I think is valuable.
Then aren't you just studying culture again? I don't understand what your argument about. What's your counterpoint to what Dan and I seem to agree about? That good and bad are just subjective
things.
Summarize
the thing you seem to agree about.
I think we think that saying whether something is good or bad is a subjective thing, mm-hmm. and we don't really have any way to back it up. We can back up things like we can back up things by picking a goal or a metric and measuring against it and then saying it was a success or not. Mm-hmm. But the just kind of objective idea of good and bad, if we're not picking any of those specific goals, is just a gut feeling. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with objectivity. It's just your opinion.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
is that fair, Dan? Is that a fair expression of it?
Not only fair, but apparently you nailed it. So my feedback, my response to that is that I think oftentimes those things that you're kind of identifying as like, oh, a personal goal are actually much greater than personal goals, right? Like, if you're an architect building a building and it ends up being a great building that is loved and used for 800 years, I don't think it's because you just set a goal for yourself of making it a building that would be loved and used for 800 years, because if it was that easy, then everyone would do that.
You can extrapolate these goals to company-wide goals, city-wide goals, countrywide goals.
What do you mean?
You can expand. I'm saying, yes, it goes beyond the architect's goal of making a nice building. But maybe the goals are it should be sustainable. It should here are the reasons why it should be livable. Maybe it's very simple stuff like we need to allow this much light in the room. It needs to take up this much square footage. It needs to have this many rooms. And by those measures, you've succeeded, and that therefore it is good. Like, that I can deal with, but
I mean, isn't that important, though? I think the...
What I just said? Yeah, what I said is important. Yeah. But what are you... Like, what's your argument?
I'm saying that all those things you just rattled off, all of those boundaries of that field, of that industry, like that. Those are the rules for a good building, right? And like
a successful building.
I mean, a successful building is success is depends on context. So successful financially, successful in terms of you know, blocking the sunlight to cast a shadow on that person's house we don't like. You know, success is always a response to a specific goal. But like whether it's a good or bad building is a response to, I think, the complex array of goals that architects have generally agreed are the rules for architecture. And that's not worth studying to you and sort of acknowledging?
No, I think that it is. I think you're just defining good as like hitting all the check marks. And then when all the check marks are hit, then it is therefore good.
I think that's how all of these industries are defining the word good in their specific context.
I don't think necessarily so, no.
Yeah, I feel like this is just a matter of language, because I think what you're
saying... Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, well, I think what you're saying as good, Andy, is what we're saying as successful between me and Matt, and we're talking about the exact same thing. It's just two different words.
What Dan said. Because what I'm defining is, like, if you achieve the goals, then you've created a success, and all you're doing, Andy, is you're just calling that the same thing as good.
No,
but when we started this conversation... I think we define good as something different. We started this conversation on the last podcast with good and bad music, which I don't think has that same assessment.
See, and if you swap out successful, like, then you take all the life out of it. Sure, you can look at the sales and say, what is successful music and what is not successful music? And that's why I don't agree that those words are just interchangeable. Like, I think there is...
No, I don't think they're interchangeable. You're the one who's trying to make them interchangeable. Dan and I are saying there's success and then there's good or bad.
You just said we were talking about, we were agreeing completely, just using different words.
Yeah, we are. And I'm saying you're wrong. You shouldn't use good that way. They're different terms. So don't do that, Andy. Listen to Dan and I here for a second.
No, but...
And use successful and then use good to mean something else.
You can't say we're saying the same thing and then tell me the opposite of what I'm saying is what I'm saying. That's not what's going on.
No, I think we're attempting to say the same thing, but I just don't think
I'm saying there is good music and there's bad music. Like,
this is turning into the best Seinfeld episode ever.
Somebody out there is really going to like this, and most people probably aren't. But, like, there is successful music, and there's unsuccessful music. And
sure.
Then, full stop, period. Music can be successful in a million different ways. You can have a, you know, what was that song that, that Chacarone song? You heard Chacarone?
Yep.
You know that song? That song was successful, right? That was on the radio. You've got Gangnam Style. That was on the radio and very popular and successful online. You've got successful music. And then I think there is a separate thing, which is worth... recognizing, especially if you're somebody that loves and studies and wants to understand more about music, which is there is good music and there's bad music. And I don't mean to say that there is discrete buckets where you take any song or any album, you can just drop it into one of those buckets and it's that simple. I think there's a lot of blurry lines in there and there's a lot of room for context. But I think what I'm trying to say is that there is some objective goodness to something that you can kind of pull out. And I don't think it's as simple as just... Like, yes, Matt, you said, like, I can't sit down and give my reasons why something is good. I think, first of all, I think you could in a lot of circumstances more than you think you could. And second of all, I think that if it was super easy, then I think it would be much easier for everyone to just make good versions of that thing. And the reality is that it's like a lifelong quest to try and figure out what makes something good, what makes something bad, and try and make good things, if that's what you care to sort of pursue. And that's totally separate from success.
So, okay, here, let me ask you this then. Given an example, like a piece that maybe Chopin had composed, it's something that's not super relevant today, and like by our standards, it's not as nearly as successful as like a Taylor Swift or something like that.
Just to stop you real quick, I would never argue that Chopin is not relevant today, just because we're not still playing him on the radio. The effect that he may or may not have had on other artists that we are still hearing is something that is very significant.
Well, the point that I'm trying to make is if you sit and listen to his music and you look at it from a critical point of view of about how music is written and constructed, so on and so forth, then it is something that can be appreciated. And it's something that, like, I think you would consider to be good, because it is something that, like, anywhere from when it hits your ears, it just feels good on down to, like, the way that it was composed is just start to finish. It feels like it was just made well. But that... is a bit different from it being successful. Like, if
I said it's different. You're the ones that are trying to tell me it's the same thing with different words.
No. What we were trying to say is that we think you were defining the building in the same way that we were defining successful, and we were saying you're using these interchangeably. We don't think they're interchangeable.
I'm saying a building could be great, and mm-hmm. just not used by people for whatever reason. Maybe the town it's in went completely bankrupt and no one lives there anymore, and it could still be a great building. Is it successful? No, it's not even being used. Like, the building is not performing its function. But can it be a great building that is worth study? Absolutely.
But the thing, so I think here's the point I think we're disagreeing about. Mm. I think that we all agree that good and success are different things. I think we all agree that we've said things are good and bad, and we have feelings about those. I think it's just that I genuinely do actually think that good and bad are subjective things, and I'm not really sure if there's something objective to, if everything about it is objective. Like, I think there are a couple of objective things, and those are probably very similar to when you define success and you pull out some objective goals there. But beyond that, I think the part where we're talking about that's kind of fuzzy and hard to define, and that's why it's so difficult to do these things, I'm not sure that those are objective.
So,
and that's not just me trying to make myself sound like a smart, educated person or like a person who doesn't judge too harshly. I just actually think that.
Well, so when you sit down to design something, Matt, you are only trying to design something that is successful because you have no idea what good is. You can't possibly make good. It's all subjective. What you think is good, someone else is going to think bad. So you never try for good. You just try for successful.
No, I do try for good. I said that earlier.
How can you try for good if you don't know what good is?
I have tastes. There are things that I like. And so I'll probably try to do some combination of things that I subjectively like and am attracted to, combined with like trying to meet the goals of the project. I'll take those two things, I will put them together, mm-hmm. and that's why it's going to be probably hard. If you do see it later and you think that it's good, you might have a hard time telling me every single reason why. Because some of those might have been subjective decisions by me, not coming from some place of higher truth or something.
And if someone was to approach you about a project you thought was a perfect example of the best design work you were capable of producing, good and successful, and said they thought it was bad, mm-hmm. just bad design, you wouldn't try and defend yourself and explain all the reasons why it was good. You would just say, well, it's your opinion, everything's subjective, we're all square here.
Honestly, there'd probably be some things I could defend, and then sometimes I just say, would you defend yourself against that person? That person sounds like an asshole.
Well, I mean, yes, practically.
I think that person sounds like a troll.
Practically,
and
that person
super
is probably not actually interested in real conversation.
Person.
But I mean, just,
like,
you know,
anybody who actually is going to do that, but sorry.
No, I mean, I'd probably
talk about a couple of points, but honestly, I probably am not that person. I'm probably not going to talk to you about the subjective points that I was attempting to get at. Mm-hmm. It seems like a pointless conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, we can agree that practically the person that is actually asking that question is not the person you want to be spending your time and energy on. Maybe you're listening to this conversation and you are really disagreeing with us amateurs as we talk about taste, success, and what makes things good and bad. Maybe you should go online and watch some videos from experts in their industries about these exact same topics.
I feel like you're egging me on a little bit, but I'm just supposed to read the copy and not have opinions here, so I guess I'll do that. Andy, this episode is brought to you by lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/OTG. That's lynda.com/OTG.
With your lynda.com free trial, you can watch such videos as Confusing Personal Taste with Effectiveness. That is a video, people.
Really?
Yeah, that's a video. Confusing Personal Taste with Effectiveness. From the Collaborative Design Managing a Team with Lauren Bacon. Lauren,
oh man, Andy, I think you need to watch that video.
Top tier name, Lauren Bacon.
That is a strong personal recommendation. I like it. Lynda.com is for problem solvers, for the curious, for people who want to make things happen. Maybe you want to master Excel, learn negotiation tactics, build a website, or prove Andy wrong. Go to lynda.com and feed your curious mind.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And maybe if that video proved me wrong, you can go watch a panel on lynda.com called A Matter of Taste. From the 2011 SBIFF Producers Panel, Movers and Shakers was the SBIFF. That's also on lynda.com. Did you know there were panel discussions? Bet you didn't.
You're reacting to me like I said something to bait you. I was just
I'm talking
the
to
copy.
The audience.
Did I say something?
I'm talking through the fourth wall. I'm not talking to you.
Oh, phew. Thank
we're
God.
Both talking.
I thought I egged you on.
Are you trying to
somehow,
sell me on Lynda right now? You know how
copy.
Ads work? You're trying to sell our audience on Lynda. I'm also talking to the audience.
With a lynda.com membership, you can watch and learn from top experts who are passionate about their teaching, stream thousands of video courses on demand, learn at your own schedule, prove Andy wrong, learn at your own pace. Courses are structured so you can watch them from start to finish or consume them in bite-sized pieces.
Prove Andy right.
Browse each course transcript to follow along or search for an answer and skip to that point. Take notes and refer to them later on the go, download tutorials and watch them on your iOS or Android device, prove Andy wrong, or create and save playlists and share them with your friends.
Lynda.com, prove Andy wrong.
Your Lynda.com membership will give you unlimited access to training on hundreds of topics, all for one flat rate. Whether you're looking to become an industry expert, you're passionate about a hobby, or you just want to prove Andy wrong, I want you to visit Lynda.com/OTG and sign up for your free 10-day trial.
And then remember, don't even try to become an industry expert because there is no good or bad. You can't be an expert. You're just all subjective out there.
Lynda.com, prove Andy wrong.
I mean, here's what it comes down to, Matt. I think the eagerness to embrace that, you know, a certain level of thing is just subjective and it's just going to be that way forever. I think what happens is a person that might bomb in, and let's just say someone says The Shining is a terrible movie. I've never seen anybody say The Shining is a bad movie, but let's say somebody does, right? Someone comes in and watches the movie and says, it's terrible. These are the reasons I don't like it. I think that that person is confusing their subjectivity, which is they might not like it, with an objective observation. And again, I am able to separate what I think is good and what I like versus what is good, right? Like, what is good? For example, like, you know, I don't listen to metal music. I have no taste for metal music. You could play three metal songs for me. I wouldn't be able to tell the difference between them. So I would never...
Well, that's just metal.
I would never in a billion years make any kind of judgment about metal music because I have no taste for it, no familiarity with it. And that would cause me, if I was somebody, if I was younger, let's just say, if I was younger and more arrogant and stupid, I would probably say like, oh, this is bad music. It's garbage. And if somebody that was familiar with metal were to hear that, they would justify it, would be like, no, it's not garbage. Here are the reasons why it's great and beautiful and wonderful and an amazing cultural contribution to everything that we do as people. But I just don't have a taste for it. I think that's where subjectivity comes from. I think when you have a bunch of people that are really invested in something and learn a lot about it, generally they find some vague consensus about a set of values for what a thing should do, right? Like, characters in movies should be complex. It's more interesting. It's more real. It's more empathetic for the audience if characters are complex and unpredictable. I don't think that's just a thing that is totally subjective and wiffly waffly, and we could find an island of people that just love simple characters and think they're way better than everything else. I think that people that don't spend a lot of time studying film and thinking about film, of which I'll include myself in that, don't have an appreciation for a complex character as much because they don't speak the language as deeply. So this all kind of ties back into our previous conversation, because I think the point of doing what we do as designers, in my mind, the artistics, you could argue that the pragmatic point reason to do what we do is to make more money for businesses, right? Like, we're really good at using our shapes and colors and typography to make businesses seem legitimate, make people give them money, make people trust them, all those things. That's a very real truth. But I also think the other side of the coin, the thing that I am more in love with about design, is that it's our job to be the ones that learn a bunch about something and develop a taste in it and understand the ins and outs, and then are able to make something beautiful because of it, because we have a greater familiarity with it. And yes, I think the more you study something, the more you get to know it, the more you develop your taste. I think your taste gets better. I don't think your taste is just this fixed roll of the dice that just is what it is. I think you're able to improve it by studying things. And if we don't agree that there's something, some things that are good, some things that are bad, then how do we agree that your taste is improving or versus not improving? Do you think that taste is just stagnant? You just roll the dice when you're born and you are what you are?
No, but I have a different idea about this. Let's roll back for a second, and we're going to go back to your character idea.
Sure.
The idea of complex characters versus simple characters. I brought this idea up before on a previous show. I can't remember how it went over. But let's just say maybe this is people that think about film all the time, and they started with simple characters because that was the easiest thing to do first, right? And then after a period of time, simple characters seem... Do they seem objectively bad? Do they seem like a bad idea? Or did we get bored with them? Did we get bored with them? And then it's more fun to have complex characters and there's more to explore there. And so we move into that instead. And now all the people that have spent all the time on film think that this is better because the other thing is bad, or they got bored with it. And I think that happens a lot too in design work. Like, I don't know sometimes if something is objectively good or bad, or we just got bored with it, and then every taste all seems to shift towards a new thing that maybe is kind of a little bit crazy or exciting or just new, And so it seems like the tastemakers shift towards that because they're bored with all the stuff they were doing previously. And maybe somebody who's less familiar with it isn't bored, or it doesn't see it as good or bad. Like maybe they don't see it as bad yet, the thing that you're bored with, because not because they're stupid or they don't understand, just because they haven't been dealing with it over and over and over again, so they're not tired of it yet.
I think that you brought up a very good point, which is that I think the challenge for me is figuring out which of these things that I may or may not have identified in my particular field of interest is this thing you're describing, right? And what you're describing is, I think, exactly the life cycle of like fashion and trends, right?
Yeah.
Like I think the fact that, you know, 6 months ago, everyone was putting like squiggly, pure blue lines all over their websites and running their text vertically. I think that is a matter of boredom, right? Like we've gotten good at making a certain type of style of thing, and then it's been used by companies and big, you know, brands or whatever. So it's not cool anymore. So we need to do something that is different to feel like we're moving forward. That is one type of thing. But I don't think when we look back on the history of design, that will just be the inflection point where we realize like, oh, squiggly lines were better. And now everything is just squiggly blue lines forever, because that was when we realized it. And how could we have been so dumb before? And I do think there are other types of things that on the surface might seem similar, but you don't go back from them. Like you realize it. Like the whole industry does make a discovery, like improves itself, gets better. And then there's no going back. And that is now how things work. And this is where it gets weird to separate things that are good versus things that are successful, right? Because to your point, Matt, you know, movies with complex characters, not usually box office smash hits, right? Not the movies that are making $50 million in a weekend, not your Transformers, or even your Harry Potters, honestly. You know, so you could say that this is just this one little batch of people that are really obsessed with this thing, and therefore they're kind of frivolously iterating on it because for their own interest, right? For to quell their own boredom. They're just making it more complicated than it needs to be. We all just agreed the best movie is just Transformers over and over again because it sells the most tickets. So why not just do that forever? And I think the difference for me is like the things that are successful in a given moment are too fickle and subject to the whims of whatever the sort of taste is at the time, wherever the culture's at. And then the things that we may look back on in 100 or 200 or 300 years and say like, this was an important thing. This still holds up. This is still interesting. That's where we get to my point of like timelessness last week. I still do think there are films that are being produced this year and put out this year that in 300 years, someone will say, this is still a great movie. And I don't think it's Transformers, but what I'm interested in is what those things are. And that's where this kind of nexus of like what's good versus what's bad and taste and timelessness all kind of comes together for me.
I really still have to question if that's true or not, because are we looking at those things just because they seem a little bit more fresh, because they were popular to a certain degree, but not to the insane degree that we got bored with it and we had to move on? Or like, I mean, honestly, I can see this in comedy all the time where like, here's an example that happened to me specifically. I spent a lot of time as a teenager, as a early 20 something, just like trying to find every comedy album in the whole world that I could listen to. And then like do research on that, try to find the people that influenced them and influenced them and influenced them. And eventually I got to like Lenny Bruce, right? The guy everybody says is like one of the best comedians of all time. He influenced everybody after him. And, I tried to find some of his old recordings and stuff. And to me, after listening to everything that came after him, it sounded a little bit boring, like a little bit hacky. Like it didn't speak to me at all. But I do know that there was a time when he meant the world to everyone who did the same thing that he did. And just like historically, he still means that, but it doesn't resonate with me. And it seems like one of those things, like if anything should be timeless, that should be timeless, but it isn't, because it was too successful. It was used too much. And it's not even a success, like a Transformers movie or something you're talking about. Like it lived for a long time. I think because it had the qualities of things that are timeless, and two, because it didn't have the supreme like reach. It didn't have the insane reach of something that gets insanely popular today. It's not, there were no billion views of something, but it still happened there. So I can never really be sure. If I see something as timeless, am I really, really sure that that's true? Or is it just something I'm a little bit less familiar with that has a lot of qualities of something that is good in quotes, but I haven't gotten bored of it yet.
So you're saying that maybe there is, I mean, it's an interesting idea to me. You're saying that the things that people in certain industries might identify as timeless are actually just like maybe remarkably good for their time period, but in the scheme of history, still just become bad.
I don't, that's the thing I don't know. I don't think that they necessarily become bad. They just don't necessarily be, they don't remain as relevant as they once were.
Yeah.
Relevance, I think, is different than good and bad. I think they're like relevance is a different thing.
But everybody is a product of their culture. Everybody is influenced by the world around them. So how, I don't even, what I'm saying is I'm not even, I can say something is good or bad only because someone else told me that, right? In this situation, only because someone else told me, I saw the movie with Dustin Hoffman. Of course, they made a movie about him with Dustin Hoffman. Of course, he's got to be great. And I understand the context, right? And I can read the court cases and I can understand the context of some of those jokes. But does it really mean anything to me if I remove that explanation? No, because of the culture that I was raised in, or specifically that I dug into and tried to learn a lot about and then felt myself bored with it later. So that matters a lot. So like, how much can you separate cultural relevancy and good or bad?
I mean, the reason it's vexing me is because, yes, you make a good point, which is that I feel like the sort of subtle or unspoken goal of almost any art, whether that's movies, you know, fine art, music, and whether it's even a goal or not, it's a contributor to its success is how much it reflects the times, right? Like the comedians that are best at a certain time, the movies that are best at a certain time are the ones that are very oftentimes a response, you know, consciously or subconsciously to something that is going on, you know, in the culture. I do think that's different though. And the best example I can give, Matt, is like, have you ever seen the original movie, The Blob?
No.
The original was 1958.
I've seen it, but I was too young to even know. It was one of those things that was like on TV at the time. I was definitely too young to pay attention or know that it was happening.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, the original The Blob was 1958. The second one apparently was 1988. And The Blob, I watched as part of a class where we were specifically talking about this exact thing, right? That the culture is, the art reflects the culture of the time and reflects sort of the humanity of the time. And the context which you watch this film was that, you know, the original movie, The Blob, when it came out, was widely considered like one of the most like scary, like thriller, terrifying movies that there could be. And the plot of the movie is there's this like slime that's discovered in like a field somewhere, and slowly the slime just starts consuming everything around it. It's kind of like red blobby material. And the explanation that, you know, the fancy art school class gives for this is that this was basically like during the Cold War and sort of all these tensions with Russia and sort of issues with communism, and the blob, this red goo, is meant to represent like communism slowly spreading and slowly infecting its way, going from person to person and kind of moving silently through sort of the background noise of the world until it's taken over and no one sort of saw it coming. And when you look back on The Blob now, it is not scary at all, for a couple of reasons. I mean, one big reason certainly is that it somewhat relies on, you know, special effects, which of course do not age well when they're from 1958. But also, you know, the argument I think is that because no one right now is scared that there is some like slow creeping, you know, ideology that's slowly like rotting people from the inside out and turning your neighbors against you, the idea, this sort of monster in this movie, isn't scary to modern people because that's not a thing anyone's scared of anymore. Where at the time that was something that was so sort of present in people's minds. And to kind of bring this back around, I don't think The Blob was a good movie. Like, I think The Blob reflected the culture of the time. I think it was fairly successful. I'm not sure. I would assume it was because it's, you know, fairly renowned. People have heard of it at least. I think that that's a good example of like something that it really capitalizes on whatever is the trend of the time, right? Whatever is the thing that happens to be going on that is extremely culturally relevant and was, I think, pretty successful, but I don't think is a great movie. I don't think it holds up under the sort of the, what I would, you know, look at as the timeless features of a great movie. And I think there are plenty of other movies from the 50s that do hold up that you could watch now and don't look dated, other than the black and white maybe, or the poor color production.
Are you defining good or great as timeless? Like, does it have to hold up in order to be good?
I think those things are very related. I think if you can look back on something
like
outside of the cultural reference in which it was created,
What if somebody goes back and watches like a Daily Show in 50 years? Something that's not supposed to necessarily hold up. Something that's like very much about a very specific time that people are pretty universally praising as good.
See,
is
I think...
Do you judge that by the same standard?
See, I think the Daily Show is an example of something that's like a really good idea. And it's not that any individual joke or any individual bit is going to be a great bit. I don't think there's lots of great comedy on the Daily Show. I think it's lots of cheap comedy. But the idea that you would do a news show and you would talk about actual current events and you would kind of poke holes in all of the sort of political climate around you, that's a good idea. And that idea, I think, is timeless. I think like that same similar idea is still happening to this day in a million different iterations now that John Oliver has his own show and what's his name?
Trevor Noah
is, well, he still has a Daily Show, but what is the other guy?
Yeah, yeah.
That still has a show on Comedy Central. I can't remember his name.
Larry Wilmore?
Larry Wilmore, yeah. Larry Wilmore has a show too, and these are all like variations on the same. Yes, I think that is a great idea, but I don't think it makes for great jokes or great TV. I think each episode of the show is not great TV. It's just a great idea that's been executed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that this is why these ideas are so intermingled for me, is the idea that you could make something that would still work outside of the immediate cultural context that you're in, that I think is what we should all be shooting for. And yes, I don't think it's easy. I don't think it's like a thing you can just choose to do. But I think that that's what I would like to do. Like I don't really care to make something that's like crazy successful. It'd be fun, I guess, but like, that's not my goal when I sit down to make something. And if it was, I would do things way differently. I care much more about making something that, you know, on the web, for example, I try to think like 5 years.
I was going to say, why do you make websites then?
Well, because I think, here's why I make websites.
Exercise in futility.
Well, no, I think that's, a lot of people have the attitude that the web is just, you know, the trendiest of mediums. It's so quick to change it. It's so easy to change it. It's so, you know, cheap to just make constant changes to it that it will always be fluctuating and changing and, you know, constantly evolving and, I don't even want to say evolving, because evolving implies that it's getting better. It'll just be constantly changing, because people get bored and people love change. So I think on the web, I like the challenge of trying to make something that, yeah, so the web is what? I guess it's like 20 years old now. I like the idea of trying to make something that in 7 years doesn't look like it was from 7 years ago. I embrace that challenge. And will I ever be able to make something that is a website that people will look back on in 100 years and say, this was a great website and still is a great website? I don't know. But I think that trying is fun, and it's an interesting problem to try and take apart. And it's what I want to grasp for. I'd rather grasp for that than grasp for getting the most retweets or getting the most likes on whatever.
I mean, I agree. I also want to grasp for that. But I think we're talking about the objective things that make that true, or like, here's an example of something like that. And tell me if you're going to pull something objective out of it. I could make a case for it too. I bet I could try too, but I want you to do it.
Go.
The Google homepage. I think the Google homepage is maybe the only iconic website.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the very, very few iconic websites.
Yes.
I would think it's very similar to like a Daily Show in that it's an idea, but why is that objectively good or bad, or is that a silly thing to ask?
I don't think it's a silly thing to ask at all. I think that the reason that page has worked for so long, and I think we can, for the sake of conversation, ignore the fact that, you know, they basically, here's what they do. In order to make that page work, they intentionally have like a little boundary for themselves where they say like, this is always going to change because we always want to be able to try new technologies and do weird stuff and experiment. And that's like, you know, the Google Doodle, right? Like they just do random shit on the homepage and they've established that as a rule. Like they're going to do random shit and that's okay. So I think part of the reason it works is that reason right there. They've already established that, you know, this page has what? Three parts. It's got the logo, it's got the search box, and it's got the search button, right? And maybe a footer, I guess. I can't picture it in my head. And they've already established that 1/3 of that is subject to change all the time, which means that they have the flexibility to not be totally boring and locked in. Another reason I think it really works is that it does what it needs to do. They have worked hard to identify what their service is supposed to do, and they've not, like, obviously, I don't think they're changing the Google homepage, again, outside of a doodle, to reflect culture or to reflect any sense of, you know, what's trendy at the time. I think they're basically just looking internally, looking into their own service and saying, what is it we do? We try and help people find stuff on the internet as easily as possible. And so when you look really closely at that goal, that's when you have a chance to actually make something that solves that problem, that is both successful and good, because it is doing that thing in a way that is unarguably works. And then they've removed any other opportunities for them to screw it up and, like, you know, mess something up and do something that's not going to work into the future. So I don't know. I think that, yes, it is the only iconic website because they have been staunch about keeping their service, you know, doing what it's doing, and, you know, not mucking it up with things. And yeah, the Bing website is not iconic because their whole thing is we have to muck it up with stuff because we're not Google. So we have to go and do other things. And yeah, that is like the trendy website. I'm going here right now and they have, gosh, on the Bing, holy crap, the Bing website. They have like a whole banner at the bottom with like news stories on it, in like little pictures. They have a little gift, add some holiday to your homepage. Oh my gosh, I can just spread, I can make it snow on the Bing website and put up Christmas lights and add bells. This is amazing. We could not have thought of a better example.
Can you put whistles on the trees too?
Oh my gosh, this is amazing. Like couldn't have thought of a better example if I had tried. Like on the Bing website right now, you can go and you can add icicles, snowflakes, you can put a Yule log on the page, all by toggling it on and off. There's just like shit everywhere. Yeah, like they're trying to be trendy and I think failing. Like, sure, people use Bing. I'm sure it's very successful, air quotes, probably the second most successful search engine there is. But this is, we're not going to look back on this and go like, ah, yes, that is great design.
There's a lot of arguments why the Google homepage is great, but if it didn't take off and turn into a hugely successful company, would we even bother having this conversation?
Well, that's kind of a chicken and egg situation, right? Like maybe it took off and became a hugely successful company because the same people that are making the decision about the homepage are making decisions about how the website should work. And like, that's a sign that they're doing the right thing and, you know, are focused and are working hard. Like, I don't know that you can separate those things.
That's what I was saying about cultural relevancy. Mm-hmm. I don't know that you can separate those things.
But I don't know, but I'm talking about in both ways, though. Like, this homepage may be a big part of what makes Google successful. I think you can make a very good case that it's not that Google was successful, therefore we all like this random homepage, but that this thing they did is their competitive edge, especially in the early days of search engines. Good God, when they came out, other search engines were like, you know, whole spreadsheets on the page. You had to, like, dig to find the little search box. So, like, I think this was a huge part of what made them great.
Well, the huge part was that it was search engines weren't even search engines. They thought the web should be a directory, and Google was revolutionary because it didn't think you should be a directory. It thought you should type
like,
something
hey,
in and find it.
Maybe we can't list all the things. Signed
yes,
Google.
Yes, exactly.
But no, like yes, I think that the cultural relevance can sometimes be a side effect of doing something great, and sometimes cultural relevance is just a matter of happening to be in line with some random trends at the time. That's why I try not to there is maybe a relationship, but it is not a causal relationship between success and, you know, greatness of something. Because
I would imagine that this example, we could fast forward 100, 200 years in the future and we could get the same reaction of like, that was iconic, that page, everybody, a billion people have done that. What is relevant about that? Like, you could explain the history and then people would be like, oh, intellectually, I understand.
No. But see, this is a great point, though. Relevant. Like, if we fast forward into the future and everyone is doing the same thing, for example, then you should look at this page and it should still work. It should still stand up. Like, you wouldn't go, oh, this is revolutionary and amazing if you don't know the history, but you would go, oh, yeah, this works. This is still a thing that is relevant and, you know, is timeless. Like, I think that's what I'm saying.
But that's the thing that's great about this specific example is that we get to say it works or it doesn't work. We're not saying it's good or bad. Like, we're using measures of success. We're not using measures of taste.
But those are the values of our industry. We're not making it work. That's the thing.
Yeah, that's the point.
So I want to figure out, like, I would love to find something in between the Google example and the Lenny Bruce example where it's relevant. It's relevant whether or not you like the Google homepage, right? Because right now we're saying it's not really relevant. It's just that you... it influenced everything after, and therefore it led to the success of the company. So then, yeah, it's good. Of course, it's good. But we're also talking about things that are still hold up to your idea of subjective, still hold up to your, or still need to hold up to good or bad, right? Like, you should still be able to sit down, if we're talking about a movie in 100 years, you should still be able to sit down and watch it and enjoy it, as opposed to the measure we're saying here, where you can just say, oh, I acknowledge that that was good because it led to all these other things, which would be very similar to your Blob example, right?
Well, yeah, I think there is one kind of like historical fetishism, right? Where you're like, oh, this was so important. This was at this crossroads in history. And from here on, everything else was changed and different. And that, I think, is also maybe independent from good and bad. Like, that is very linked to cultural relevance, right? Like, if you are able to be Lenny Bruce and change the way that stand-up comedy is done by, you know, trying some things and doing something that wasn't done before, and people have a very positive response to it, that could be because you are great and you've made an amazing revelation and your work is going to stand up over time, or it could be because you just happen to be at this point in history and make a certain number of decisions that just happen to ring true in sort of culture. And some people, mm-hmm. I think, have a really, not you two, but I think a lot of people will be listening to this and thinking, like, it's and not separating those things, like, it's just assuming that success just means it's good, right? Because everyone liked it and that's what we're all shooting for. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very possible, Matt, that I have never listened to Lenny Bruce's comedy. I don't have anywhere near as much taste for comedy as you do. I think it's possible that he's just maybe not a good comedian. Like, maybe he's not good. Maybe he's not timeless. Maybe the people that love him just love that he was so important historically, but you can be important historically without being great. I think that's entirely possible. I also think it's possible that maybe he is great and you just not to your taste, which is also fine. It's just, I think there's value in talking about what's good and bad and what's great and what we should all be aspiring to.
I do think there's value in talking about it, but I don't know that we're going to really nail it down. I think it's always going to be...
It's a journey.
Some conversation about, yo, yeah, it's... Yeah,
I don't know why else you go to art school
with no destination.
If you don't want to spend,
with absolutely no destination.
I honestly don't know why else you study music theory or film theory or go to art school if you don't want to spend a huge part of your life trying to figure out what makes something good and what makes something bad. Like, if you're going to go to those places and do all that work and just at the end of the day pop at the other side and say, well, everything's subjective and it's just whatever people are into at the time, which is just a roll of the dice, then I don't understand why you do all of it. Like, ultimately, this comes down to, like, a deep fundamental part of like why I do what I do is because, yes, I want things to be good. And I think there are good and bad things. I don't know. It just, I feel like so many people,
I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah. But that's still, I don't know. It still feels very weird because, like if somebody goes to film school and they go through like film theory and, they go there to eventually discover the things that like ring true to them, the things that they aspire to do, that's going to be a different set of expectations than somebody else in the class. Like, they're going to find something else that they're going to want to aspire to. And those two people are going to have two different definitions of what they feel as individuals is good.
Ah, see, now we're back to the kitchens. I know. You can have a million timelessly great movies that have almost nothing in common. Like,
yeah.
It is possible to have all of these things be great and be very, very different. And that's the beauty of it. That's the diversity in all of these creative pursuits.
But, I mean, here, I'll tell you my story and I'll ask you your story, Andy. I don't necessarily do all the things that I do because I'm trying to figure out what is good and bad. Like, the things that satisfy me the most are when I'm part of a bigger goal and then we accomplish that goal. And the projects that excite me the most are ones that seem to have pretty exciting goals, and I want to be a part of that. Maybe it's just that I don't get these projects, but like, if I got a project that had nothing to do with a goal and had everything to do with just like me finding out whether something is good or bad, how appealing would that be?
That's why you're a designer, Matt. That's why you're not a fine artist.
Like, I'm
not
sure. but is that? I don't get the sense that that's what motivates you either. I think you also like finding the bigger goal and trying to accomplish that, not so much just finding out whether your own work is good or bad.
I like puzzles. And so for me, oftentimes the context of being presented with that larger goal is like, all right, we have a puzzle to sort out. I mentioned to you, Matt, in Slack, but right now we're working on an app, which is like a preposterously simple app. It is an app that allows people that are coming out of surgery that have a like drain attached to them, kind of gross, or draining, you know, fluid out of some part of their body that they need to sort of keep track of. It allows them to keep track of the drains coming out of their body and then send it to their doctor so they can, you know, prescribe a better sort of path to recovery. It is basically whenever you empty your drain out, just type a number into this app and we'll record it for you. It could not be, it's the most simple app I've ever worked on, which is kind of refreshing. At the same time, figuring out how to do this seemingly simple thing and do it in a way that it actually makes sense to people is like getting down to like the like deepest core essence of user experience and, you know, interface design, mm-hmm. where making this thing that's so simple actually work and make sense and not be too weird is a fun puzzle to unpack. And that is a totally distinct and separate thing in me from the thing that wants to make good stuff in the world that will stick around and be worth it in a while. Like, it's fun to do puzzles, right? I really like to be involved in a project with a big team and lots of different mm-hmm. Sort of conflicting values and trying to make compromises and figure out how to get something from not existing to existing. That's one part of me. Another part of me wants to, like, make great stuff that will stand the test of time. And right now, this drainage app probably just has to look like all the other apps in the App Store because who's got the budget to make the drainage app timeless? And it also, like, it has to be popular. Like, it has to just look right. So we'll make it kind of match whatever's going on in the App Store right now. Maybe we, you know, try and push the boundaries a little bit. But mostly, I'm just kind of taking apart this puzzle. But then separately, like, I also want to make things that don't just, you know, sell something in their own time, which I think is what so much design comes down to. Like, yeah, it's really fun to be on a big team and figure out how to sell something and be successful at it and watch all the sales go up. But mm-hmm. at the end of the day, like, that kind of bums me out overall.
Being in a profession that stemmed from advertising. Got it.
No, I know. Dan, no one is more critical of the roots of graphic design than me. I shouldn't say no one. I'm extremely critical of the roots of graphic design because that, I think very few people reckon with the fact that that is what we are doing as an industry, is just selling shit to people. People mm-hmm. have these kind of dreamy ambitions. I think it's okay to realize that. And that's, you know, I don't know. I don't know how to put it, Matt. But I think there's different things in me. I like to do both those things. For me, the one is kind of it's a short-term goal, right? Like, here's a project, working on it for, even if it's a long project, working on it for a year. Like, make this thing work for a year and sort of think about it for a year and figure out how to do it the best you can. That's a mm-hmm. small scale challenge. And like the long con of my career and life is like trying to unpack this idea and trying to get to the bottom of it to some degree. Mm-hmm. Which is larger what like the podcast is more than anything, honestly. Is that the episode then? Are we done making a podcast?
Yeah,
I guess so.
Yeah, let's.
What did we think of that one?
I still think I'm right.
I still think I'm right, and I appreciate your wrongness.
I appreciate your trying so hard. You're digging a hole to nowhere, I think. Which is, that doesn't mean that it's pointless, but I don't think you're going to come out the other side or come back up with something in your hand.
So you really think all the purpose of all of the places people pay money to learn about a thing, they are just being taught cold technical skills and nothing about what actually makes things that are good and bad, because it's impossible to do that. You're digging a hole nowhere.
No, I think you're being taught technical skills and then some history or culture,
which is just subjective and doesn't matter.
Well, it's also a bit skewed based off of who's teaching it.
Of course it is, for sure. Yeah. I'm just saying that, like, I'm not saying we're succeeding, but I'm saying that I think the point of going to school for something is to learn what makes it good and what makes it bad and how you can be one of the ones that makes the good ones.
I will say, it does, it really pushes my buttons, like, it really...
Oh, it grinds your gears?
No, in a good way. Like, everything I want to be about is the idea that there is objective goodness. I would love that. I think it would be great. You read that, I don't know how the world feels about Sam Harris anymore, but I've read a couple of Sam Harris books, and the moral landscape one, I think, is fascinating. He's the guy that did Letter to a Christian Nation. He did Letter to a Christian Nation... Why can't I say that? You wrote Letter to a Christian Nation.
Maybe it's because you're the devil and you can't speak the Lord's name on your tongue. That's
true. And the moral landscape, which is the idea of trying to come to some sort of like objective morality through science and not through religion. And I think the world currently doesn't like him because he's critical of all religions, and so therefore he's Islamophobic. I think that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. That does happen sometimes.
It does happen, I think. I think it's unfortunate. Like, I think there is, one, there is a Islamophobia, and it's called Donald Trump. And then, two, there are just people who don't like religions and think they lead to bad things, and that doesn't make them bad people. That's just the general opinion you can have.
You can call me religiophobic. I'll take that.
Yeah. And I think I generally fall in that category where I think, well, I think a lot of these religions have the same problems, and I'm not calling anyone out specifically. I'm just saying that, like, we're relying on some pretty old books with some pretty outdated ideas, and they can lead to the bad stuff for everybody. And I think that should be a much more acceptable opinion to have.
I think, anyway. I definitely have faith phobia. I'm very scared of people that will just believe things in spite of all logic and reason and, you know, other things pointing that maybe they shouldn't believe those things anymore.
But anyway, Sam Harris has written a book about the idea that perhaps we could come to some sort of scientifically agreed upon morality, which I think is, you know, I don't know how to take it. Like, I've read a lot of criticism of it, and I really can't tell if it's like actual criticism or just like upset religious people or even people who are just upset at the idea of the kind of like new atheists, like people who are just annoyed that atheists have a voice. You know that kind of person I'm talking about? Like, they seem like the new version of cool because they're so far beyond everything that they can even be like, I'm annoyed by religious people and atheists because they're their own religion and they're equally annoying.
It's very cool to be annoyed by things. Yeah, everyone loves to pretend like they're above everybody else by being annoyed by them.
I'm so above everything, I don't care about a single thing. I don't even have opinions about stuff. I don't even like anything.
We'll call that aggressive agnostic.
Sure.
Well, I mean, to your point, Matt, to bring it back to our topic a little bit, I think just because I would like to spend my life pursuing this. I think it is a thing. I want to learn more about it. I want to learn how to do it as much as possible. I don't think that ever empowers me to write something off because I think it is bad. Just because, you know, something is bad by the sort of way we've been talking about good and bad throughout this episode, as we've said, doesn't preclude it from cultural relevance, doesn't preclude people from loving it, doesn't preclude any sorts of things. So the idea that you would write something off because of that is just narrow-minded. And I think that's why people have such a visceral reaction against it, because they assume that if I say I think there are good things and bad things, that I'm inherently writing off all the bad things and writing off all the people that like the bad things because I would like to just, you know, be judgmental. And it's not. I would just like to learn from the things that have proven themselves through the ages.
Yeah. That's the part I struggle with, is it seems much easier to have this conversation when it's about morality and we can just say stuff.
Wait,
like,
does it seem easier?
To me, it does. Because really? Then it seems like there's much clearer lines in the sand as to what is right and wrong. And then we can say, can we just make those synonymous with good and bad?
Wait, so you feel like there's more clarity when it comes to morality in terms of what's right and wrong than when it comes to
than like musical taste? Yes.
That's shocking to me.
Is it?
It is, yeah.
I think it's a lot easier for me to say that rape is bad than it is for me to say that
The Shining is good.
Somebody's favorite band is bad. Yeah, or The Shining is good. Yes, I do think that's easier.
Well, yeah, there are some things like that, but, you know, I don't think many people disagree on those kinds of moralities. I think it comes down to things like you're programming the self-driving car.
Well, actually, there are a lot of people that disagree with that.
Rape culture is a thing, sure, but
No. That's not what I mean. That's not what I mean. There are plenty of people that would say if there is no God, then people would just be raping each other because then everything is subjective.
Those people scare me.
That is not an insignificant amount of people that have that opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you take away that one point of objectivity, then everything breaks down from there.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And so...
See, maybe we shouldn't do our secret Pope plan. We might cause some problems.
I'm always wary of these people, too, because I'm like, are you absolutely sure that a God is the only reason?
For the season.
Are you sure?
I can't believe in my heart that very many people are actually... that is the reason. Like, I don't know they'll say that.
So many people say that. People say that so often. So
yeah,
I don't know where to...
I have to believe in my heart of hearts that more people are governed by more things than they would say out loud when it comes to those circumstances. But for me, when I think about morality, I think about programming the self-driving cars and deciding who to kill. Like that's where morality really falls apart for me. that's what I'm saying, moral challenges.
That the kind of like the point where you say like if there's no like objective God who defines all morality, then everything falls apart. That part is bullshit, because there are plenty of people who don't rape and murder, and it's fine, right? And they don't have a God to pull it all together. But there isn't a scientific like 100% counterpoint to God, which there never is. It's kind of a stupid argument to have, because it's not like they have to be exact mirrors of each other in order for one to be false and one to be true and vice versa, right? But that doesn't mean there is a scientific answer to objective morality. So can we get there? Like, could we piece that together? Or is it just like consensus? And then if it's consensus, like, aren't we saying that's subjective? That's the same thing as culture, right? Consensus is the same thing as culture, kind of?
Kind of, sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, morality is definitely intensely tied to culture.
So then we're back to the idea of cultural subjectivity, objectivity, trying to say. Cultural relativism!
Ah, yes. I have heard of that term before.
Anyway, that's a whole... Like, in my heart, I don't believe in cultural relativism. But I don't know. I don't actually know. Which is the same way I feel about good or bad. Like, in my heart, Kendrick is good. And...
Kendrick is good. Don't want anyone to tell you otherwise.
But do I really know... Do I really have the science to back it up, Andy? I don't know. I'm not sure.
I think if we spent years studying music theory, we would have the words to explain why Kendrick was good.
I will say there is one objective truth in the world, and that is Killer Mike is good. Did you watch those Bernie Sanders Killer Mike interviews yet?
I haven't yet, but I'm going to.
Oh, so good. That's the one thing I can hang my hat off. If Killer Mike is the objective good, everything can come from that, and that's the reason I don't kill anybody.
Despite the fact that his name is Killer Mike.
He kills the mic. He doesn't kill people. This has been On The Grid, episode 146. This week, I want you to find us on iTunes, search for On The Grid, and give us a nice review. Thanks to Dan for the interlude music, Glassboy for the ad music, Girlfriends for the theme music, and finally, thanks to you for listening. Until next week.